Day six of our vernal equinox session here at Tohomazen Monastery. This is also our weekly Sunday Zazenkai. So welcome to those of you who are coming for Zazenkai and having a little flavor of retreat. For session, as we have for this whole last year, we're reading through the Discourse on the Inexhaustible Lamp of the Zen School by Tori Inji, the principal Dharma heir of Hakuin at Kakuzenji. And in the section that we've been reading, Tori Inji has been comparing the Zen School with the textual sutra schools and the esoteric Shingon school. And primarily in what we were reading yesterday, he was discussing in terms of the esoteric school, and then he has broadened it out into this discussion of how Chan and Zen differ from the other forms of Buddhism in general, primarily in the core sutra schools, of which he would be particularly thinking of Tendai and Pure Land and Huayan, the other kind of really major, the Kagon is the Huayan in Japanese. So in this section, it's useful for those of us as practitioners to kind of see what distinguishes Zen from these other practices. In essence, it really comes down to Zen just says, sit, look within, see the same truth that the Buddha saw, the same overall process. And we have our methods, but this is it. This is, as I've said many, many times, the one true teaching of Zen, and really of the original Buddha, was you have to see for yourself. Everything else, skillful means, ways to explain it, metaphors, pointers, encouragement, etc. So it's useful to see that, but it really comes down to that. But he gives a little bit more explanation here, so this might help you there. There's also a certain amount of sectarian cheerleading for Zen. I tend to be of the view that the one truth of sitting and seeing it for yourself is not really obscured in all the Buddhist teachings. Most Buddhists do know that. I mean, there are certainly those, I'm sure, that practice it kind of just as a religion, worshiping the Buddha and such, right? I mean, it certainly happened in certain cultural conditions. But in general, the main textual schools, I mean, particularly the Tendai and the Huayan, which have their own meditation practices as well as a very detailed examination of the principle, the essence of things. These are just different paths, and they appeal to different types of mind. Certain types of mind, I think, need these kind of explanations and the use of metaphor in the way that these schools do it. And that was the point I made about the esoteric school yesterday, which I know very little about, mostly what I've learned here from this reading. But in the way that it works through revealed knowledge, and using the Buddha's insight as a metaphor for revealing the mystery, manifesting the mystery. So the mystery of what the Buddha saw, right? His awakening. A lot of these things are much more Buddha-oriented, right? Pure Land, this esoteric school is much more oriented around Buddhas as either as a powerful metaphor, as a powerful figure. And you see that throughout a lot of that. We're going to see some of this in the reading today. So let's just dive right in. We're reading section 63. Long ago, in southern India, when Ruju Daishi stood in front of the iron stupa, he empowered 7 white mustard seeds and threw them at the gate, which at once flew open. Ruju was about to enter when the 4 heavenly guardians stopped him. Ruju, prostrating himself, repented, and in the end was allowed to enter the tower where Vajrapani Bodhisattva initiated him. Ruju memorized all that he was told carefully, and after his return wrote it down, and so it came to be transmitted. So here's a more classic Indian Buddhist tale, where we have this kind of interesting sort of, magical type effects and spiritual beings and such. And Ruju, it should be noted, is the Japanese pronunciation of Nagarjuna, who was the major kind of philosophical Buddhist figure, kind of at the cusp of the dominance of the arising of the Mahayana. So Mahayana scriptures existed, and Nagarjuna cites them, and is really claimed by the Mahayanas, but in his teachings he does not deviate in quite from the classic Buddhist teachings at that time, from the Agama. And he doesn't really deviate from the other ways that they divided up and classified the practices and the philosophical understandings, but he really developed the philosophy in his own direction, in what is called the Madhyamaka, right? And that's the middle way, and in the Madhyamaka of Nagarjuna, the middle way is there is no stance taken on whether form, right? So if emptiness. If there's emptiness in form, the absolute and the relative, and the relative is empty, right? This is the truth of conditioned arising, of codependent arising, is that there's nothing essential, there's no eternal thing that remains when you break down all the conditions that cause something to arise. So the middle way for Nagarjuna is that there's no stance made on whether forms exist or not, right? They're fundamentally empty. They have no permanent essence, but do they exist or not? And this, philosophically, is the middle way between nihilism and eternalism. These are the two real views. Everything is empty. It's a nihilistic position. There's only emptiness. This can be contrasted with monism in a kind of classical Western philosophical systems. All is just this one substance. There's a singular substance, in this case, emptiness, and that's a monism, and that's a nihilistic view. And then this contrasts with eternalism, something, there's some essence that exists forever. In the Western view, this would be the classical dualistic position, right? That the reality is made up of two substances, matter and some sort of transcendent element. Could be matter and emptiness in a view, like a dualistic view of that, or in traditional Western views, it would be like matter and soul, something like soul, spiritual energy of some sort. And that is an inherently dualistic position. And of course, dualism is highly flawed in that how do those substances interact? Nobody's worked that out, right? That's the problem with dualism. And it's this eternalistic view, because the soul is eternal. So this is the middle way of Nagarjuna. And the Madhyamaka is very oriented around emptiness. It looks at all this emptiness, even though it doesn't take an eternalistic view, right? A transcendent view of emptiness. Because the ultimate truth of Nagarjuna is he also points out that emptiness is empty. It's not a transcendent realm. There's not a realm of emptiness. Sometimes people think that when we talk about the emptiness is like this generative tissue from which all things arise and fall back into, that there's like a pool of emptiness somewhere out there and everything kind of comes from that, but it's not. It's just what you see in front of you right now. That's what there is. We're going to get to that in the next bit of reading here. So let's get to Kadaibi's comment on this story of Nagarjuna. Ruju Daishi was one of Brahmin caste and lived 700 years after the Buddha. So that would be about 200 CE. He is the 14th patriarch after the Buddha and a direct disciple of Kapimala, who had inherited the Dharma from Asvaghosha. He had obtained the Kagon Sutra from the Dragon King and from the Iron Tower he passed on the Secret Store, thus becoming the patriarch of 8 schools, both exoteric and esoteric. Such is recorded in his biography. Now, this demands some explanation. The Kagon Sutras are the Huayan Sutras, the Flower Garland Sutra. These are the sutras that are said to be the teachings from the perspective of an awakened being. The claim is that these were the original, these were among the original sutras that the Buddha spoke. And the Flower Garland Sutras is a collection of 10 sutras that circulated independently at one point and then are all collected together. So Nagarjuna could not have really collected them all from the Dragon King. The story about this and also some of the other Mahayana sutras was that the Buddha said these originally back in the day, 700 years before Nagarjuna, but this was so difficult for people that they were whisked away. There's stories of like literally heads exploding upon hearing this material and some of the other Mahayana concepts. So it was taken and put under the sea where the king of the Nagas, right? The dragon king, the Nagas are these kind of snake-like dragons, guarded these sutras and I think some of the other Mahayana sutras. And so I guess, and I'd never actually read this before this, but I didn't realize that Nagarjuna was there. And obviously his name has the Nagas in it, so I'm not sure what the Juna means, but perhaps it means something like rescues from the, or works with the Nagas or something, who knows. But anyway, so he brought these out, freed them from the Iron Tower, and thus it says became the patriarch of 8 schools. And this is because Madhyamaka was influential on literally all of the Buddhism that descended from this. It became the formulation, right? So this and then the Prajnaparamita literature is what really is the formulation of the Mahayana, as well as various bodhisattva treatises as well. Indian philosophical systems like Yogacara that are somewhat in opposition to Madhyamaka was still highly influenced by it. And so then all of the really remaining, these schools all kind of claim this as a fundamental teaching. All of Tibetan Buddhism takes this as a fundamental teaching and many commentaries and such on Nagarjuna in Tibetan Buddhism. The essence of this is encapsulated in things like the Lotus Sutra. So the Lotus Sutra-oriented sutra schools, Tendai and Nichiren, owe themselves to this. The Huayan, right? These are these scriptures that he rescued, Nagarjuna rescued from the Dragon King, the Kagon Sutra, so that thing there. And then Huayan and Madhyamaka and Yogacara are all big influences on the formulation of Chan in China, as well as Taoism and Confucianism. But those are the Madhyamaka and Huayan and Yogacara are the big influences on Chan. So we chant in our lineage, we chant Ruju Daishi in the lineage chant. So the patriarch of all these different schools. He continues, the iron stupa is in southern India. When Ruju Daishi stood in front of it, he empowered 7 white mustard seeds and threw them at the gate, which at once flew open. About to go in, the 4 heavenly guardians refused him entrance. He prostrated himself and repented, and at last was permitted to enter. There, Vajrapani Bodhisattva initiated him into the secret dharma of the great sun Tathagata. This is a parenthetical. It has always been considered that in Toray's text, the phrase into the secret dharma of the great sun Tathagata is missing after initiated him. Ruju accurately committed to memory every word of the Dharma Gate, and on his return, he carefully wrote it all down. This compilation became known as the Great Sun Sutra. As a result, sutras have to be considered with regard to both objective rendering and principle. So what he's saying there is, have to be considered with regard to both objective rendering, that's the story as related, so there's the surface story, and then as it relates to principle, so as it relates to ultimate fundamental reality. In the above, Toré presents the objective description, and below he interprets it from the principle of the Dharmakaya. So this is Nagarjuna's story in terms of principle. Southern India means shining empty purity. The iron stupa is the basic delusion, literally not clear. The seven seeds are the seven branches for enlightenment. White means pure. A mustard seed is a single thought and refers to meditation. The stupa gate opening means the opening of samadhi. Entrance refused by the four heavenly guardians means separating the true nature in order to appropriate for oneself the bliss. Prostrating oneself and repenting means authentication. The great sun is the intrinsic nature. The secret dharma is the dharma gate with which the intrinsic or true nature is endowed. It is called the sermon of the true nature. The diamond hand, Vajrapana, means wisdom gained after Satori. Initiation means final total understanding. Keeping in memory without forgetting means that if once gained, it is never again lost. And rather than remaining in the realm of the bodhisattva, he returns to benefit sentient beings. So you can see that literally every line, every word almost in this, has this way of which it references the perspective from the absolute, perspective of reality. And this is absolutely standard in Indian Buddhism, and as I mentioned at the very end of the talk yesterday, the way that Chan teachers are always, they're both indirect and always working with multiple layers of meaning. And it's in this same kind of way. And this allows for there to be a very condensed meaning in Buddhist sutras. And where I've talked about several times during the course of this retreat is the way that the sutras speak to where you are at. So as a very young beginner practitioner, the surface story might be enough. It might be this interesting story to kind of captivate you, and you know that there's something there. You know that it's talking about receiving wisdom here. So you know that's there. And then as you come later on, you might begin to see these depths in it. In the Prajnaparamita literature, the whole Prajnaparamita literature is almost always, it's a bunch of sutras, and they're all like the Prajnaparamita in 10,000 lines and the Prajnaparamita in 5,000 lines. I mean, the whole thing is like this until all the way down to the Prajnaparamita in 700 lines, and that's the Diamond Sutra. The Diamond Sutra is getting at kind of a slightly different angle than a lot of the other Prajnaparamita literature, but it's covering the same material, just in 700 lines. And it's also, the Prajnaparamita literature mostly focuses on the emptiness of things. And the Diamond Sutra kind of covers the emptiness of things in a few lines and then kind of gets onto the what's real. And what's real is, of course, true nature is what's real. And it uses the metaphor of the body to get at that. So the Dharmakaya is what's real. I mention this because when you read the Diamond Sutra, it sounds like it's just repeating the same thing, even though it's so few lines comparatively. It says the Buddha will say something like, if you take all the grains of sand in the Ganges and you give the three jewels for each grain of sand, and you give those all to, you give all those as gifts, right, as dana, would your merit not be great? And so this is repeated over and over again. It'll be like, well, then all the grains of sand, if there's a jewel for all the grains of sand in the Ganges on all the worlds and all the possible realms. And there's these subtle distinctions on the gift given and, how many grains of sand they're compared to. And all of these things, the different gifts and the different formulations in that, all reference other sutras. And it's almost impossible to just read it. When I read the Diamond Sutra at age 18, it seemed kind of repetitive. You could tell there's a lot of things in there. And then the parts that were, more unique in it, where it's not this giving of merit, I mean, it's all about It would then say after about the gaining of merit, it'll say, well, it is greater to just read any four lines of this sutra than to get all that merit, right? So he's making these several points. But the condensing in the Diamond Sutra is what's really impressive when you realize that the reason they would say the three jewels for this, because those all have specific meanings. You know, and there's treatises on each of the jewels that are being referred to. And it's in going through greater and greater value through the course of the Diamond Sutra. So it does begin with things that are kind of like treasure. So giving away money or giving food or giving support to people would gain you a lot of merit, right? But not so much as the teachings. And then, then there's things later on. But the last one of these is giving of life, right? Giving up of your life to help other people. But it's not put in that way. It's still very kind of obscured. And this is this kind of level of this. So when you unpack the Diamond Sutra, it's actually this very large thing if you really explain what everything is. So if you read Red Pine, Bill Porter's book with commentary on the Diamond Sutra, it includes commentary both from himself and then where he explains that. He explains what these things mean, and then he also has commentary from a variety of Chan and Zen teachers. But even if you took out the Chan commentary and you just had his explanation of that, the sutra is, that book is a 700-page book. So, it's really worth, the Diamond Sutra is always worth reading, and that text is the most useful one to read because all this stuff can be unpacked. And, once you kind of get it, then you can just read the text and you can get more in there. But this is exactly in the same way where Torrey is explaining that. And the Daibi here will be on even greater length explaining what these things mean. So let's dip into Daibi's commentary. Southern India, from the point of the Dharma principle, is not a geographical location, but is understood as meaning pure clarity. Nor is the Iron Tower an edifice, but is the basic not being clear. Sanskrit, avidyaya, usually translated as ignorance or delusion, the first of the 12 links of the chain of causation or dependent origination. So you see, this is further unpacking, right? So then the original story just says Southern India, and he entered the tower, approached the Iron Tower. And so Torrey points out that the Iron Tower means not being clear, right? It's iron, you can't see into it. It's clear, the metaphor there is pretty clear. But Daibi notes that not being clear is the beginning of the 12 links of the chain of causation or dependent origination, which, as I noted, Nagarjuna and his teachings didn't break from this, right? So the chain of dependent origination is the path of the Pratika Buddha, right? Working with just that. And so in later, when the two lesser vehicles are really poo-pooed by the Mahayanas, you can see that it's not, these things are kind of, they're always taken, these are truths, right? Provisional truths, but they're a way of getting at reality, but that provisional nature the views of the three vehicles or the Bodhisattva path, can just be seen as a lesser, right? These are lesser vehicles. But Nagarjuna still upholds all these in his teaching, even though it becomes very radical. In Buddhist teachings, we create karma from the error of not being clear. Thus, sentient beings in a state of delusion incur suffering, transmigrating along the three paths of delusion, karma, and suffering. This basic, or original, not being clear, is the iron stupa. The seven grains correspond to the seven branches of enlightenment. Within the gradation of training along the Buddha's path are the path of seeing, the path of training, and the path of no more learning. So along the way of training, when thinking is cut off, it is necessary to rely on these seven branches of enlightenment. And everything, of course, in early Buddhism was divided into these easy to memorize stages along the path. And the seven branches of enlightenment are that, as one becomes increasingly clear. And we can think of this in terms of, as we've talked a lot about this, and I have another talks here at Tahoma, where you have that initial all at once awakening, and then the long period, the gradual refinement, the gradual practice. And it's the same thing, working on these kind of ideas of these stages. You have to have that initial seed into true nature, and then subsequent breakthroughs to work through conditioning and to clarify our understanding and to move to this period of no self. So what he says here is like the path of seeing, so that could be like the original breakthrough, and then the path of training is like the myriad breakthroughs, which is how they call it in Chan. And then the path of no more learning is when you're at the one of these later stages where you don't need to look at pointers from sutras and such. So, you know, all these things tally, as Zhang Mi was so adamant to teach us. There are two types of delusion, the delusion of seeing and the delusion of thinking. The former is to be deluded as to the principle, and so can be cut off by the way of seeing. And that means deluded as to principle is to deluded as to fundamental reality. And so, you know, deluded about it, and so that can be cut off by the way of seeing. Should be kind of a right view, sort of, or seeing into original nature. Delusion of thinking is to be deluded by things, and by things, it should be noted, would be more like the five skandhas, right? So that includes forms, but also would include thoughts and sensations and such. Deluded by things, and as these in turn constitute the subtle afflicting passions, it cannot be cut off all that easily. An old master said, "The delusion of seeing is cut off suddenly, like splitting a stone. The delusion of thinking is stopped gradually, like cutting through a lotus fiber." So cutting through the delusion of thinking is a gradual procedure, like cutting through the fine and sticky fibers in the stem of a lotus. So you see, this is exactly the all at once awakening and gradual practice, where he just even says here, cutting through the delusion of thinking is like a gradual procedure, whereas cutting through the way of seeing is seeing into true nature, right? With regard to the seven branches of enlightenment, there is the capability for enlightenment, and the branches are a means for classification. There are seven such branches. One, discrimination of the true and false. Two, zealous effort. Three, being at ease. Four, recollection. Five, equanimity. Six, samadhi. Seven, joy. As to these, the comments of the old masters are concise and to the point, and so need no lengthy explanations. One, in the realm of seeing, discrimination of wholesome and unwholesome. Two, diligent and firm practice of what is good and wholesome. Three, body and heart settled in peaceful gentleness. Four, keeping clarity in all circumstances. Five, free of any inner upheavals, emotional or ecstatic, calm equanimity. Six, remaining at one with all situations, the mind is not distracted. That's the samadhi one. Seven, inner joyfulness. And it is often said in these systems that when you go through this path and you've gone through this samadhi, right, the other portions of this path are also cultivating mindfulness. And this cultivation of samadhi and mindfulness is samatha. And that has this aspect, this affect of this kind of wondrous joy, you know, in all things. It also gives you a very firm support. You're very rooted, grounded. And so in these systems, as after this point that you've developed the samatha, that you would then work on vipassana or insight, which would lead to these, the going through the way of seeing and the way of thinking, those delusions. A mustard seed is an instant of thought. It is minute, but it by no means must it be neglected. The manifestation and transformation of the Tathagata means true insight, that is, insight into me and my mind. The stupa gate opening is the first opening of samadhi. The four heavenly guardians protect the Buddha Dharma against the outside. Their refusing entrance is analogous to an instant of joy arising at the moment of entering samadhi. Because this instant of thought separates from the true nature, the insight is not yet clear, hence the refusal. And this is one of these things where when people first kind of enter samadhi for the first time, right, and they have gradations of samadhi, of course, there's four gradations of samadhi, the jhanas, they people can attach to samadhi very easily, especially when you get to the later, the deeper samadhis, because the sense of self recedes. It doesn't go away, right? Because it's not, samadhi's a state of mind. It's not a breakthrough into ultimate reality. And so having a break from yourself, right? You're in the incessant narrative in your head, the incessant feeling of all this stuff, just, you know, the human condition, a break from that is, that has this addictive quality. So in a lot of Chan teachings, they don't teach samadhi practices. They teach you kind of the edge of samadhi, so you can concentrate in that way, and then you move on to something. You move on to the vipassana, the inquiry techniques, like koans and such. And so that's what he's getting here, that because this instant of thought separates from the true nature, the insight is not yet clear. So you haven't broken through because you still are basically enjoying, right? And what is enjoying this kind of separation from self? It's still the self, right? You're having a little break from aspects of the self, right? The narration and these feelings and such, but it's still there, the conditioned self. Hence the refusal. Bowing in repentance means giving up one's body and throwing away one's life. Wholly throwing down one's body with muscles, veins, flesh, bones, and hair, letting go of both mind and body. Nothing is so fearsome as truly giving up one's body and letting go of one's life, but with determination, it can be done. A trainee must go through this stage at least once. And this you hear all the time in the teachings, right? Roshi says this all the time. You must experience this at least once, right? And to the self, the sense of self, this is talking about going past the sense of self. And to the sense of, to our constructed selves, when it disappears, it is death. It is death to it. You know, that initial time, its support structures are such that it will come back. But it doesn't know that. You know, you don't know that. And it feels like death is approaching. And since our bodies and minds are not separate things, it feels like just standard death approaching. And this is why this is called the great death. Right? And not there are actual bodily deaths that occur. Those are just, that's just death. This is the great death, because we really, it's like a deliberate thing that you're doing, and it's the dying of the self. And you can have your bodily death later on in life. They often just say dropping the body is the way it's often put. And it's not such a thing, because that self that's grasping, holding on to life, holding on to itself, has already died. It's gone. And if you go through this process, it doesn't come back, or it transforms in a way. It transforms more into a function, but we don't identify with it anymore. You don't identify yourself. You're just original nature, is what you are. Even if you have a discriminated, individuated body and mind, still those things still exist. You still operate in the world, and the functional portions of the self, which is how we intermediate between the relative world and the absolute, how original nature expresses itself, is this functional aspect. I often have quoted Ramana Maharshi when he says that for him it's the it was the it was like the self was this on a shelf, and he would take it down off the shelf and use it when he needed to use it. So he's interacting with somebody, takes down that, it can interact in those terms that that person can deal with. And then when he's done interacting, puts it back on the shelf. So the self, in that sense, is a tool. The great sun does not mean, wait. Permission to enter is the confirmation, authentication of Satori. The great sun does not mean something separate, and rather is the true nature with which we are originally endowed. So that's one of the many, many metaphors and synonyms we can use for something that no words really get at, but the great sun, light. You often use light. The secret dharma is the dharma gate to the true nature with which we are endowed. This, Master Rinzai expressed as, in the eyes it is seeing, in the ears it is hearing, in the mouth it is talking, in the hands it is holding, in the legs it is carrying. From morning until night it shows itself freely and without hindrance, and as that is the sermon of the true nature. And this is actually really the essence of Lin Chi's teaching. Very oriented on the body and on functioning. And all of our functioning reveals original nature all the time, if you just have the eyes to see it. The diamond hand is wisdom gained after Satori. Wisdom can be divided into two, original wisdom and the wisdom gained after Satori. Original wisdom is the great wisdom of equality and is inborn. But the wisdom gained after Satori is the wonderful wisdom of differentiation. In one's practice, it is attained by training after Satori. All the difficulties with the koans, hard to penetrate and hard to understand, are but for the attainment of this after wisdom. Now, this is an incredibly important point, and I've talked about this in different terms quite a bit. So Kensho is that scene, you know, what we often translate as a breakthrough or an awakening, seeing into one's original nature, right? And then what they use Satori for, and we often translate as enlightenment. And I think a distinction between those two is pretty key. As Hakuin noted, he had 19 major Kensho before he achieved Satori, right? So that's this process that you undergo. So I like to think of, I don't particularly like the term enlightenment, but if I do use it, I reserve it for when you've gone through the whole process, right? So in Chan distinctions, it was the original awakening, the multiple awakenings, and then the prison barrier, the last vestiges of the self stripped away. And then you are enlightened. And what he's saying here is that after you've had that initial breakthrough into emptiness, and that might actually be more than one for most people, since, as I noted, that first breakthrough is very shallow. But you have this thing into emptiness, and it can be this sort of undifferentiated emptiness of all things. But then you have to have the realizations into form, right? Because you are seeing in that breakthrough that form is emptiness. That's what you're seeing. But the next thing you see is that emptiness is form, right? And this all ultimately comes to the nirvana is samsara, which is the really operational view of this later period stages of Buddhism, right? Especially in the Chan tradition is really used in. Just what is in front of you right now is reality. This is it. It's fundamentally empty and it's fundamentally here. And that's something that you have to see for yourself. And this, he says here, is the wisdom of differentiation. And in the long koans, part of the koan study is that there is this various types is the breakthrough koans to see into the emptiness of things. And there's koans that deal with the absolute to kind of keep that always in mind as you go through the system. Every so often you go through one that's back into working with the absolute. But many, many of them have to do with the relative and seeing the absolute in the relative, seeing the relative from the absolute, seeing that this wisdom and gaining this wisdom of differentiation. And a lot of it is through functioning. The Lin Chi style revealed through functioning. Our actions reveal the absolute in their very nature. And you see it from many, many angles in the koan work, and you learn this over and over again. Over and over again, you work into this, and you dip into this, and that leads to these multiple breakthroughs as you go through, work through this, and you learn this, and you embody it. And slowly but surely, our conditioning that keeps us separate from these understandings, right, from this way of operating in the world, a road. Transmitting and receiving means deliverance, and remaining in the mind without forgetting means once gained, never lost. Returning points to the original purpose of a bodhisattva, which is to assist all sentient beings. Thus he remains not at the stage of attainment, but according to the vow of benefiting sentient beings, returns. The above is Master Torre's exposition according to the principle. Following below, he comments on how this relates to actual training. So this we can see, this also ties into the Dongshan's five ranks, this view, and also the 10 oxherding pictures, which all cover these kind of the path of enlightenment. And this is following the Mahayana path of the Bodhisattva. The final of the oxherding pictures is returning to the village with helping hands. Before that, you are able to really do that free flowing and without hindrance, as you see into the emptiness of things, and then you develop this wisdom of the relative, of differentiation.